and welcome to Geek History Lesson. I'm Jason Inman, and today we have a very special bat episode. Today's episode of Geek History Lesson is going to feature an episode of a podcast that we're a big fan of. It's a podcast called the Arkham Sessions Podcast. It's hosted by Dr. Andrea Letamendi and Brian Ward. And if you're a bat fan, you're going to love this podcast because it offers a unique and engaging exploration of the complex psychology of the characters from Batman the Animated Series. And not only that, the episode we're featuring of their podcast today is from WonderCon 2023. It's a very special panel that celebrates the 30th anniversary of Batman Mask of the Phantasm. And they had a couple of very special guests. Joining them on the stage was none other than Eric Radomski, the co-director of this very iconic film and the visionary responsible for the unique visual style of Batman the Animated Series. Plus, there's a surprise guest in the form of Geek History Lesson's own Ashley Victoria Robinson. So you're going to enjoy this episode. You're going to go subscribe to their podcast, and then you're going to get ready for a deep dive into the world of Batman as this panel explores the psychology, the artistry, and the history that made this beloved animated film a true masterpiece. So stay tuned, listen to the entire episode because it's a very captivating discussion about Gotham that you don't want to miss. And now, here's the episode. Enjoy.
My name is Brian Ward. I am the co-host of a podcast called The Arkham Sessions. We started out by analyzing every episode of Batman the Animated Series through the very clinical lens of a psychologist. With me is that psychologist. She is my co-host. She is also a psychologist at UCLA. She has been written into canon by Gail Simone as Batgirl's therapist. She can be seen in any number of bonus features from Warner Brothers. Just about all of their animated movies, they know to come to her for psychological science, including coming up, there's the bonus feature for the new animated film, Batman, The Doom That Came to Gotham. You can see her in that. This is Dr. Drea Letamendi.
Hello. Good to see everybody. Happy WonderCon.
Also joining us is a co-host of one of my all-time favorite podcasts, Geek History Lesson. She is Ashley Victoria Robinson.
I don't have any skills or qualifications.
Not true.
I'm just here to whine about how Robin isn't in this movie.
And then our very special guest this year. He is one of the co-creators of Batman the Animated Series, chiefly responsible for the look of the show and the movie, Mask of the Phantasm. He's also the co-director of Mask of the Phantasm. He is Mr. Eric Radomski. We were supposed to have one other panelist from History of the Batman, London Jackson. Unfortunately, this morning she was unable to attend, but she did send a couple of quick messages. One, she says, "I'm terribly sorry, and I couldn't make it to this amazing panel to celebrate Batman with all Gothamites in attendance. Mask of the Phantasm is perhaps one of the best Batman films that explores the man, the mask, and the city he inhabits so timelessly. It can always be enjoyed and appreciated." Also to Mr. Radomski in particular, she is sad that she couldn't meet and talk with you today. She wanted you to know that she wanted to thank you for helping bring to life the film and the classic DC animated universe. Your work on Batman the Animated Series universe propelled her into getting into comics years ago and kickstarted her fandom, and she'll always be thankful for your talent. But we did lose a couple of people that are key to this series. Just a few days ago, Mr. Michael Reeves passed, story editor. Eric, I would love to ask you, how instrumental was Mr. Reeves to the legacy of Batman the Animated Series?
Very much there as long as we were. As the team was assembled, Alan Burnett, Paul Dini were the first couple of our hardcore writers, and then a cavalcade came from there, but Michael was on from very much the beginning throughout the series and then on to the movie. Much like the directors, it was split amongst several participants from the series that contributed to making Mask of the Phantasm. So, of course, you know, sadly missed as long as the next person you're going to mention, who passed not so long ago. And it's hard to believe it's been that long, you know, long enough for people to get to the point where they're leaving us. So forever grateful. And again, his work lives on beyond him. So we're very grateful.
Absolutely. And then, of course, we'd be mistaken if we didn't mention Kevin Conroy, who left us this past year as well. To most, he is the quintessential Batman. I just wanted to ask, starting down here with Drea, because I know how important this series in particular was to you and your career. Talk about what Kevin meant to you.
I don't think I'm alone to share that Batman the Animated Series and this version of Batman, Kevin Conroy's Batman, influenced and impacted so many of us. For me personally, this Batman was so deep, so emotional, so dynamic in terms of psychology that this series and this film is what propelled me into behavioral science. And it's not an exaggeration to say Batman the Animated Series influenced me to become a psychologist and to go into the field of behavioral science. So I think losing Kevin, it felt so unexpected and early. And, you know, I know that he was such a legacy, an icon for many people. I almost want to say he raised many of us in our fandom. So it's such a tragedy, but also I know he'll be with us for the rest of our lives.
What you're saying is we are all his ward.
Yes.
Actually, what about you? What did Kevin bring to this role that was so important to you?
Well, one, this is a weird association, and I'm sure Drea is going to be analyzing me as I say it. My father's name was also Kevin, and he passed this a lot more years ago. So he's always had kind of a weird dad quality for me personally, just with the name association. It was so lovely to get to see Kevin get to embody Bruce Wayne in live action when they did Crisis on Infinite Earths, because animation, thank you, doesn't always get the veneration that it deserves. And I think that that really cemented his legacy in the larger DC universe. But I am also an award-losing all-ages comic book writer. And when we sit down and script out our stories, we are always looking back at Batman the Animated Series and then the adventure comic books that tie it back in for the type of quality of storytelling. So to say what Kevin Conroy and this show and this film means to me, it creeps into so many strange parts of my life.
And then, Eric, what do you think Kevin brought to this role that made everyone embrace him so?
Well, it was the authentic approach to it. He said it many times in interviews that he had not really done voiceover, especially for an animated series, prior to coming to the Batman auditions. And he came at it as a consummate actor, and took the role as serious as anything else. And as it was described, you know, we knew him when we heard him, because we had heard several before. Several is an understatement. And he just, not only the quality of the voice, but there was passion and there was sincerity to his performance. And that not only sold us from the beginning, but I think as he became a fan of the art, he applied everything that he had brought as an artist to it. He never looked at it as just a job, and he always described it as, you know, Shakespearean. And that that authenticity came through in the performances. So the fact that the stories were written in a way and always went back to the source material to be authentic, to bring a performance like that, it's not something you could predict. It's something you would love to say that you planned, but it was just sort of this wonderful marriage of a true artist coming for the first time to a new medium and applying his pure art to it. And, you know, we're all the better for it, all of us that were part of it and enjoyed it. And it just speaks to the fact that, you know, there it is the magic of animation, where it's a disembodied voice combined with a bunch of artwork and some storytelling, and suddenly we're watching, you know, a 2D animated show, and we're believing every minute of it. So that speaks to his, you know, his not only his true artsmanship, but also the passion and the sincerity to the role. Because, you know, it at the end of the day, it could be just a job, you know, and that's fine too. But this was something I think, you know, had he experience in other roles prior, might have put barriers up and, you know, rules. And he did none of that. He literally just came in, spoke from the script, and performed it the way that he thought it should be, and he blew everyone away. So you know, it was a privilege and an honor to work with him. But again, when we met him, he was just another actor, Kevin Conroy, coming in to audition for a part. So pretty great.
That's fantastic. I want to ask the fans on the stage, what does Batman the Animated Series, and specifically Mask of the Phantasm, mean to you 30 years later?
It's the best Batman movie ever made, and nothing else has ever touched it. So to say that it's like the pinnacle of my Batman fandom from a filmic perspective is not hyperbolic, but I watched this last night. I've watched this movie on the big screen at the Egyptian. I was too young. My parents thought it was too scary to watch when it first came out. But I've seen it so many times and I never get sick of it. And there's always more to explore. And then the legacy that it leaves, not only for Batman the Animated Series, but a lot of Batman projects going forward and the rest of the DC Animated Universe at this time, with some of the casting choices that will carry on, mm-hmm. is just so incredible. It's almost unfathomable in a way.
It really continues to stand out and make sense even after three decades. If you haven't seen it lately, watch it again. It really does stand the test of time. In terms of character development, of course, the drama that unfolds, it's almost like a Batman soap opera. It's potentially you know, available psychologically for youngsters. I saw it when I was a kid for the first time, but as an adult now, I think I appreciate it for very different reasons. And so it really does have layers to it that I think could be the reason why it's so timeless in terms of its psychology, and why I find it to be such an excellent piece of art, is that the questions that come up, this goes along with Kevin Conroy's performance, the vulnerability of our protagonist and the internal conflict, the questions that are raised about essentially what are we supposed to be doing with our lives, is such a deep question for a cartoon, right? And I think that's what elevates it to the point where all of us can sit with it and really begin to kind of take that in within our own insights and our own sense of self. And the fact that it's with a character that is so beloved, a character that many of us have grown up with and are attached to, we really are with that story. We're able to sit with that story and endure through the drama. And I know we'll probably talk about how everything ends, but you know, it can be a very heavy film to sit with.
And I want to stress, for those that don't know, you credit Batman the Animated Series for your interest in becoming a psychologist. We've told Alan and Paul this. We've told Lauren Lester this on panels. Now we get to tell Eric.
Yep.
You genuinely credit Batman the Animated Series as your gateway to psychology.
Well, you know, Batman the Animated Series is a stewardship into trying to understand people's behaviors, especially people who do not, you know, look, act, seem like us. There's this respect for otherness. There's an understanding that if we can really do that detective work, we can truly begin to understand the origins of people's faults, the origins of their despair, and the choices that they make, their motivation. And while other superhero stories can get there, really the animated series was one of the first that delved into the deeper dynamic of many of its characters.
Eric, I, for people who aren't familiar, I would love for you to describe the role of a director in animation, because I know a lot of people instantly when they think film director, they think someone on an 8x10 talking to an actor, usually pointing or doing a gesture like this. They've got a big coat and a ball cap. Your job is ever so slightly different than that. Please describe for someone the difference between an animation director.
Sure. Well, director title in general is such a specific, and yet, you know, it's so understated in terms of the scope of responsibility. And animation only compounds that. And anyone who claims to be an animation director will have come up through the ranks. You don't step into a studio and just become the director. You really have to understand the process. And from a technical standpoint, I'm talking about actually making the film. So your duties are knowing how it's made and how to fix problems as they come and being able to be true and honor the script that you've been given to, you know, to bring to life, essentially. But it's much broader and much more deep than just having an idea or a perspective on something. You've got to be able to execute. And that's the part that often gets missed. You know, a lot of folks love to wear that hat. And yet when it comes down to it, you know, in the case of Batman, and I've held this all along, you know, since I've worked on it, and thank goodness for all the success and all the fans that love it. But truth be told, you know, we were working on really slim budgets, and it was a crack pace, you know, schedule to get things done. We had some influence from the outside in terms of networks, and obviously we're working on a IP that had existed for, you know, 60 years before we got into it. So you've got all of those things weigh into what the director has to deal with. And a lot of it can be a distraction, and you're still trying to get the job done on time and within your budget parameters. So a director's got to be fairly, you know, diverse, not only have good ideas, be able to fix problems as they come up, but you have to be tolerant of a lot of influence and a lot of input. And then, you know, the gravy of it all, and I say it on every production I'm on, the production is the easiest part because you're dealing with so many personalities and so many influences, and you want to do justice to the story you're telling. And that's ultimately the director's job, is to preserve the integrity of that story as much as you can. So, you know, the other end of this that throw out to all the folks that are fans and any animation you watch, you know, be careful before you start criticizing a lot of different shows that come out. And, you know, it's easy to just see something and dismiss it. But remember that it went through tons of hands under incredible, you know, scenarios that you have no idea what they might have been. And, you know, a lot of folks that work in this industry don't choose to spend, you know, 80 hours a week for months on end to put something out there for people to immediately dismiss it and say, oh, that's a piece of crap.
Like, what?
That's, you know, that, you know, and it happens, you know, so I'm getting into the weeds with the director of it all, but the director has all those things to consider. And at the end of the day, you hope you have enough time within dealing with all those other things that are swirling around the production to be able to focus and tell a story that's not only compelling, but that people could allow themselves to believe. And that's, you know, it's a tall task. It's a heck of a lot of work. And when it works well, you know, we sit here 30 years later and talk about it. So we're very fortunate to be part of that team.
I want to ask you again, as a director, how much does psychology play into your job, rather whether directly or indirectly? How much are you thinking about the characters and making them three-dimensional for a 2D medium?
Yeah, in the case of Batman, it was a unique scenario, obviously. The best thing that could have happened was, believe it or not, in the beginning when Bruce and I started, no one paid attention, you know, which was fantastic for us because we were a growing studio at the time, and there were a lot of other things that were being, you know, important things that were needed attending. So as we started out, it was just the two of us kicking things around. Alan Burnett came on shortly after and gave a little bit more, you know, organization to the storytelling part of it. But the reason I bring that up is to your point about how much do you, you know, you put into the psychology of the characters and exploring that. Again, it's a luxury, especially with television animation, because the schedules are so incredibly tight. The budgets are very tight, so you want to do justice, and at the same time, you've got a couple of weeks. It's like, you know, so the good thing for us on this project in particular were most of the folks that we had as part of the team were fans of not only the character, but of the source material. So we're familiar enough with, you know, even though, you know, a lot of directors, writers would have their own perspective on, you know, or take on some of the characters, the core material was always consistent. And I think everyone had the same intention in mind to preserve that. Some other shows don't have that luxury of, you know, the history to build on, especially brand new shows, because you're creating that psychology. So as much as you want to apply that, and you need to apply that in order to give integrity and believability to the characters, you don't always have time to. So again, a little bit in the weeds, but to Ashley's point about you know, being her favorite movie, for me, it's sacrilege for me to say it, I, you know, made this movie, but it never really was a movie. It was essentially going to be not only direct to video, but it was in our term, coming off of 65 half-hour episodes, it was a couple episodes laced together. We had a little bit more time, and it was going to be a direct to video, so we didn't, even at that, we could embellish a little bit. Not until it was in the middle of production did they tell us it was going to go on the big screen, and that was to my absolute horror, as opposed to thinking, oh, it's a movie. It's like, no, this is a really bad idea. And, you know, Godsmack that so many fans love this as much as they do, and I'm, again, grateful for it. I see the quality in what we were able to do, and the pure joy and appreciation for what we were able to accomplish, but it's hard for me to, you know, to say it's a film, because I feel kind of ripped off, because any other animated film, any other film that you would consider an animated film has a minimum of 2 years of a production schedule. Right. We had under a year. And even though we had, you know, built the art direction from the series, this was a whole different monster. And it was just sort of laid in our lap and said, you know, go and get it done, and we're going to put it on the screen. And, you know, it was not the perfect scenario to make a movie. And with that, doesn't matter now, but it would have been twice as good had we given just the time and the money to do it better. We didn't need any more input. We didn't need the, no disrespect to Pixar, Disney, we didn't need months and months of thinking and rethinking and putting the story up and tearing the story down. We were confident with what we had. We just didn't have enough time to do it as well as it should have been done and it deserved to be done. So the fact that it came out as good as it did, and the fans were so generous to accept it for what it was and embrace it because they were all in, that's what made the success of this film. There's no doubt about it. So
I'm curious to ask if there was something you had wanted to do with the film had you more time.
Oh, absolutely. And a lot of it would have been truly taken advantage of the things that everyone seems to react to, you know, the not only exploration of the characters, but even the way that things were shot and staged. We could have made more of it. And it would have been, again, more of an honor to the quality of the story that we were telling. And we did a pretty good job with that. But, you know, as any artist, anyone who, you know, creates in any capacity, you always want to do it better. You always know that it could have been better, and all the things that jump in front of it to cause you to have to make decisions and just move forward. So, from a true, you know, film making perspective, it would have had a lot more, just a lot more quality in terms of camera choice and execution of the environment, and you know, even the way the Phantasm was presented, we would have, I know for myself, I would have liked to have kept it even more mysterious and more in the shadows. But again, it just was, we just didn't have the time, and but it plays, and you know, what do I know in terms of everybody loves it. So thank you for that. But,
and to your credit though, famously, if you can find this on YouTube, Siskel and Ebert even apologized for not having reviewed it when it was in theaters because they didn't know that it was there. And then on video, they said, this is the best Batman movie we've seen.
Yeah.
And so even if I realize that that there's always something the artist would want to have done differently, but you got two guys who aren't particularly known for being won over all that easily, both raving over this film and then making it their pick of the week for VHS. It was pretty incredible. Part of what made this movie so fantastic was just the depth of character. It's one of the first times that we've ever seen a genuinely vulnerable Bruce Wayne. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We've seen countless iterations of him on his knees with his parents and pearls strung across the ground. But this is the first time we've ever seen him going to their tombstone and asking to be let out of his promise to even be Batman before he'd even gotten started. Dre, I want to ask you about this because you've talked on our podcast many times about there being sort of a trifecta to Batman. There's Batman, there's Bruce, and then there's the playboy Bruce Wayne, mm-hmm. who we see at the beginning mm-hmm. of this film very clearly, and he's very much not the same character who's on his knees at the tombstone. And then he's not really the character under the cowl. So talk a little bit about that and Batman in this film.
What I appreciate about this film is that there is a significant amount of time that we spend with Bruce. We get to know about his vulnerabilities and the tension that he's living with in regards to what he feels he needs to do to resolve the grief that he's experiencing. And then the things that he feels he could do, the sort of the possibilities in his life, in this case of having a healthy romantic relationship, perhaps a family, and put down the cowl and cape, this concept that it's at a point where he can't integrate those things into his life, is a really sophisticated question to ask in a film like this, but it really works. I have I've thought about Batman for decades, but I think in terms of the trifecta, the sort of dimensions of his personality, I don't think he has any kind of multiple personality disorder or something like that, but he's able to kind of compartmentalize the public persona that is Bruce Wayne, the shadow of Batman, which a lot of times pulls him in. A lot of times he gets lost in, a lot of times he's quite vulnerable to, and then who we might consider a more authentic integrated person, which I just simply call Bruce, a very familiar name. And what we all want for ourselves is an integration of all these desires and wishes and goals. And what he's dealing with, of course, is the conflict of what do I do with these different obligations? One might even compare this to like a super ego, ego and id. How do I live with these various layers of the self? In this film, we see a quite socially busy Bruce Wayne with women falling over him and showing interest in not just dating him but in marrying him and this sort of refusal publicly to be in relationships, but also this interest in being standoffish. He does not want people to be close to him. And then what we have is, unfortunately for him, really just one close relationship, which is Alfred in this movie. It's just Alfred. And the introduction of, or the reintroduction of this love interest reignites and allows him to remember these different feelings that he knew were available to him. And so, all these things are very sophisticated, mature themes around the self and the development of the self. But what I think really draws me to this film over and over again, and I think was probably core to the development of this film was the story of traumatic grief. How do we deal with long-lasting feelings of loss and anguish and despair related to the death, in this case, the death of his parents, in the Phantasm's case, destruction of her life. And we see the pursuit of vengeance. We see these desires to act out on these urges to find closure. And the questions come up about, you know, whether all of this is worth it. And I think, again, those are very common developmental human questions that we all deal with, too.
I want to ask about that relationship that you're bringing up. This is the first time that we've ever seen anyone make Bruce question whether he should even go out and pummel the criminals to begin with. Maybe he can have a healthy life. He chooses to pursue this relationship, and then he's sort of unexpectedly ditched one night when she has to skip town, which then pushes him into becoming Vengeance in the Night. Because up to that point, he wasn't even Batman yet. He was just a dude wearing a black outfit and, you know, stopping some people taking things off of trucks. But so I want to ask about the power of this relationship. Ashley, what do you think about Andrea Beaumont and this sway that she has on Bruce, really, even in the present day? I mean, there are moments where he starts to say to Alfred, I don't know, maybe this could work.
Should have put a ring on it. That's my thought about it. No, she is such an incredible character in all facets and all complexities, because she's kind of like a dark mirror to Batman and Bruce, which is wild because Batman and Bruce are already a very dark mirror on humanity and on all of us. If you've ever fallen head over heels in love with someone, even if your relationship with them has ended, you often want to make huge changes in your lives for them. And if your secret is not like, I got a lot of long boxes in my closet, it's that, oh, I was hanging out with Rachel Gould and I go and beat the snot out of people who probably need to just go to rehab. That can be a harder thing, I think, to grapple with. And I think that's why, if you start watching this movie when you're 5 and then you watch it when you're 15, 25, 35, 45, hopefully we're all watching it when we're 105. I think that's why it still resonates. I'm not as smart to know maybe why that would be and why that's as aspirational in all of us. But I live my life hoping that we get to see Andrea make another big screen appearance. Even though, spoiler alert about the end of the movie.
Well, and at the end, well, so that actually brings up an interesting question that we've had when we discussed this film on our podcast before. One of our friends, Livio Remondelli, asked if, because the two of them, Batman's mission is sort of abstract. He just wants to beat up crime. She was going after very particular mm-hmm. people. Had she completed her mission prior to Bruce finding out, and then Batman finding out, do you think this is a woman who could have led a happy life with Bruce there in Gotham? You know, if she had completed her mission, unlike Bruce has ever been able to do.
I think there's only three women that Bruce has ever interacted with where he could have had an actual relationship with. I think it's Silver St. Cloud, Selina Kyle, and Andrea Beaumont. Mm. And Andrea's my favorite choice among the three.
I'm curious to hear what Eric's thoughts are for sure on this. I feel an obligation to talk about the science of closure when we pursue or we fulfill the urges we have around revenge. And there's a tremendous amount of literature that actually shows that there is little that's actually fulfilling in the long term when we pursue these more extreme, especially aggressive or violent related end results, because we feel wronged or we feel something was unjust or unfair. Going back to traumatic grief, the reason why traumatic grief is so important to explore and think about, especially if we're pulling from entertainment media or the popular arts. Something that we can really gain from this is that, yes, those feelings make a lot of sense to us. We feel angry, we feel rageful, we have the urges and impulses to go after the people that have wronged us. And the definition of traumatic grief is when the loss or the trauma specifically feels unjust, or it feels sudden and unexpected. There's something unfair about it, and we feel we must do something to correct that. And so what Andrea Beaumont is doing is somewhat relatable. It has this essence of fairness to it, and I think that's what makes her such a cool character. And yet the reality is, typically, even when we fulfill some of those wishes, that actually does not resolve the internal despair, the anguish that we might be experiencing at a deeper level. And so that has to be explored and reflected. Typically, a loving, healthy relationship that might be available to her would be a more likely source of repair.
Speaking of Andrea and the hold that she has, even right up to the end, spoiler, she Batman's Batman. She just, in a cloud of smoke, just kind of hugs the Joker and pulls him away. And we've talked about how much Batman and the Joker need each other in this city anyway. And now he's now watching the love of his life take his other love of his life.
Yeah.
And we never see the Joker again at the end of this movie.
And that's how the DC Animated Universe introduces polyamory.
Talk about that relationship, Batman and the Joker, particularly in this film. Even the Joker says straight up, you know, it's just too exciting to me alive. You know, what do you think about this relationship?
Is that to me?
Sure.
Oh, okay. I do want to comment on the Andrea Beaumont part of it. That for me, and this might be my own melancholy, hopeless romantic. I don't want a sequel to Batman of the Phantasm ever. Yeah. And what it does for me, and has done throughout the success and the fact that it survives, is the fact that Andrea represents the true humanity of Bruce Wayne. Mm. And it's also the driving force for Batman, in my mind, that he had a glimpse of everything that's beautiful. And it's the very thing that propels him forward for the possibility that that might happen again, whether it's Andrea or somewhere else. And it may be the very thing that drives him to continue to fight the fight for himself as well as anybody else to have that opportunity. So for me, it's, I like the way that it ended. I like that it's not truly a Disney-type ending. Things don't always work out the way that you want, but they work out the way that they should for that given story. And that's the other thing to remind, is that, we concocted this. So it could be and could have gone in any number of directions, but the way that it went was the most satisfying for me, and it felt appropriate for what the series represented and the trajectory of the characters in the series. As far as the Joker-Batman relationship in this film, we took some liberties, obviously, because on one hand, we're showing it's the start of Batman, but by the end of it, it's kind of like they already have a rivalry, but so we took a lot of liberties with that. So I think a lot of the question about that came from anyone who was aware of the series prior, because it was already established what this dynamic was about. But to your point, as far as the composition of Andrea combined with the Joker and Bruce/Batman in this incarnation of the story, it's exactly as you said. They were two incredibly opposite and yet equally important driving forces in his life, and they were both going away. So talk about having a bad day. That was not a good day for Bruce/Batman.
I want to ask you about Gotham City itself. You're largely responsible for the look of Gotham, and it is a character unto itself in this film. Even in the beginning, we feel how alive Gotham City is simply by going through a single tracking shot through, you know, the various skyscrapers and whatnot. Talk about Gotham and what importance that city has to a character like Batman and in this film.
Well, it, you know, from a purely aesthetic perspective, it, you know, it's essential because we, this depiction of the character, we wanted him to be mysterious as often as possible, looming and you know, striking fear everywhere he appeared, and it had to be out of the shadows. So the whole concoction of the way the environment was originally conceived was to be able to support that throughout. But as far as what it represented, you know, it's big city to anyone who's ever been to a big city. They're giant, you know, structures that have hidden, you know, alleyways and hallways, and they're larger than life, and they have their own sort of living, breathing existence within that, you know, that environment where people go in and they do things in there and they come out and they're there at night, and from a distance they look beautiful, and yet you can walk down an alleyway and be terrified. It's all the psychology of what, you know, this unknown maze that a city is, that we took advantage of. So to add the night to it and all of the characters that embodied it, just played on everyone's fears and concerns and, you know, mysteries of what's looming around the corner. It's as old as, you know, being cavemen and cavewomen, that, you know, there's something out there that you better be prepared for because you don't know what's going to happen. So, you know, to put a character like Batman in there, both as a threat to the, you know, to the baddies, but also the vigilante that you want there protecting you in case you're on the other end of that. That's kind of the way the city comes to life. And we never say it. It just exists. And what we tried to do was always use it in staging to help fill in the gap for something that wasn't actually spoken. It had to speak for itself. So that's why you can look at just a piece of artwork from the series and know that the city represents the series as opposed to just Gotham City. It's representative of all of the emotion that was tied into creating the stories around it.
I almost imagine the creation of Gotham as being similar to the film Dark City. Just every night, the layout of the whole place changes. It's easy to get lost in, both physically and emotionally.
You need every building to have a ledge so that Batman can kind of stoop and mope there with his binoculars.
But they also have the cool, like, skyways between the buildings.
Yeah.
And the blimps. And when we were creating the city where we set our comic Jupiter Jet, we were like, we're doing the skyways and we're doing the blimps like Batman the Animated Series.
I think I know the answer to this question already, but before we open it up to audience questions, I want to ask, 30 years later, what does Mask of the Phantasm mean to you? Does it hold up?
Does it hold up? I mean, yes. I think if it didn't, this would be a very different panel. We'd be all out here with our little puppets lampooning it and making jokes. This movie means a lot to me. It's a litmus test on whether I respect your opinion on film, honestly. If you have not seen it, you must in my presence. And if you don't like it, you're wrong. And I think for a lot of creators, it's, we aspire to make something this cool with a character this beloved.
Drea?
Absolutely. I, you know, again, if for some reason you're here and you have not seen Mask of the Phantasm, just leave, no, don't leave WonderCon, but make sure to check it out. You know, again, it no matter what your age, no matter what you're going through, there will be something there that that you can relate to, or that touches you, or that has you, you know, again, do that internal reflection. I think for me, why it is timeless is the essence of who Batman is in this film. The question about what to do in your life when you reach a point of decision making. If anyone has ever made a commitment to what's important to them, whether it's your job, whether it's your family, whether it's a set of values, this film will help you reignite that, remind you that you do what you do because you care about this intentionally, internally, immensely. And, you know, I've just watched this film days ago and I thought, yes, this is reminding me why I do what I do. So it's forever going to be so awesome.
I want to ask if there are any questions. We've got a mic up here. Come on up and we've got about 8 minutes, so hopefully we can get through as many of them as possible. Yes, sir.
Hi. So now that you mentioned that if you had more time, you would make a better movie. Now I kind of want to see the Eric cut. Release the Eric cut.
Hashtag release the Radomski cut.
Yeah.
But I guess my question is for the entire panel. What is your favorite live action Batman movie and why?
I'm going to say Batman 66, the movie, because Batman 66 doesn't get the respect it deserves.
That is true. Andrea's actually never seen any of Batman 66, so we're...
Well, you've got about 8 more years of podcasting out of that series.
Yeah, we're going to... I think for me, it's got to be 89, mm-hmm. probably because that was right in that sweet spot, and then it directly led into the animated series, so that, yeah, probably. No, that's your.
I have to check in with my co-host. I usually will say Batman Returns is my favorite Batman film. Mm-hmm. There we go.
Eric.
Great.
Oh, as you said, Tim Burton's first was the inspiration for this. It was my entree into the real Batman. I had only been exposed to the '60s show as something to watch after school and never took it to heart. I was in a different place then. But Tim's movie, can criticize it in so many different places, but to be introduced to that character in that setting changed my perspective to a character that existed long before I, and I'd never really understood, appreciated, until that film. So it was pivotal for me. As far as filmmaking goes, that's everybody's got an opinion about which film they are. So.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Okay, so I got a question for the psychologist.
Great.
So what's the difference between a sociopath and a psychopath? And are the Batman villains more like a sociopath or psychopath? Explain it to me like you are our college professor.
Oh, wow. Well, we only have, 4 minutes left. So what I can do is, and it's an excellent question, by the way. This question comes up a lot. And what I will do is celebrate, actually, the variety of different representations we see in Batman's rogues gallery, all the different villains and anti-heroes and characters that... That we get to see play out, in especially in the animated series. And my short answer is there isn't a single diagnosis that can capture all of those different representations, but that there are a lot of them, most of them are showing up with histories of trauma, histories of loss, histories of interpersonal conflict. And so as an easy way out, I'll say that many of them exhibit high conflict personalities, which is not even a diagnosis, but it's a respectful way to say that it's hard for them to get along with people.
including Batman.
Including Batman also is an HCP, high conflict person. And about your question about sociopathy and psychopathy, clinical psychologists will tend to steer away from those words because they are not diagnoses, and will say words like antisocial personality disorder and other terms that might better capture those experiences. Criminologists will probably use sociopathy to describe somebody who has no remorse, very little guilt in what they do, an interest in violence, an interest in bettering or putting other people down. And we see some of that in some of these villains, but we also see that sometimes with Batman. And I will end that response.
I have been told we've got time for one more question. Yes, sir.
Hopefully make this brief. Again, kind of a follow-up to the psychology question. I know in the end, given this decidedly darker tones of the animated series when it first came out, were there boundaries that you tried to stay within to say, keep that darker tone, but keep it accessible to younger viewers? And when the mandate came to make a movie, a theatrical release, did you straddle any further for the theatrical portion, or did you try to keep it within those same boundaries?
Adding to that, that I noticed you still see in the version I saw the blood on both the Joker's face and Batman's face. It's interesting.
Yeah. For the series, you know, we're always beholden to broadcast standards. That's all television shows. For our show in particular, because it was an action drama, we had a little bit more wiggle room, but we still had to abide by the types of violence that would be unacceptable for a network to broadcast. And at the same time, a lot of times the notes, we actually had a t-shirt made of all the contradictory broadcast notes that we got throughout the series.
And from executives, one, never.
one example that kind of speaks to all, we had a character, there was a fight going on, and basically the note back was, you could kick the character in the chest, but you couldn't punch him in the face. So it was a weird sort of line. So we would always look for ways of staging things that implied much more violence than there was. But we were never allowed to show blood. So for your the quick answer to your question, for the movie, we were allowed to have blood, which, you know, I don't know that that added any value, I guess. You know, it was risque 30 years ago, but to today's standards, especially in the gaming world, it's laughable. But we didn't want it to become brutal or violent. It wasn't going to add to the storytelling. It, again, the sake of the panel, or the very theme of the panel, this was about the psychology of the characters and how everyone could relate to that. And that sometimes is even more, you know, more to deal with than getting punched in the head, you know. having to deal with the emotional wrestling match that was going on throughout the film was much more powerful than a trickle of blood on someone's face.
I want to ask the panelists, where can folks find you online, or if they want to get in?
Well, I hate question. To, I guess, I don't know if it's even a term, but I'm antisocial, so I'm on social media nowhere, and I don't know how you'd find me, so sorry.
They got to hire you for a gig, and if they want to talk about...
That's different. I'm not giving out my phone number.
I'm Ashley V. Robinson on everything. The V is very important because Ashley Robinson is a 6 foot tall WNBA player. I don't want to fight for SEO, but I do want to meet her, and she lives in LA. So if you know her, let her know that I exist. You can find my podcast, Geek History Lesson. We have 454 episodes where all fine podcasts are had. You can buy my award losing comics at AshleyVictoriaRobinson.com/shop. I'm not on the floor. Today's my birthday and I'm going home after this.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Oh my gosh. Thank you for doing this on your birthday.
Thanks for inviting me.
Oh
my
gosh,
birthday.
This is a birthday celebration. You can find me on social media at Arkham Asylum Doc. My website has all of my articles and the podcast. It's drdreapsychology.com. Please check out the Arkham Sessions podcast. It's super fun. We analyzed every single episode of the animated series and moved through various other stories and IPs after that. And then finally, please check out Batman, The Doom That Came to Gotham. I'm in the bonus features and talk about the psychology of that film, so please check it out.
Thanks, everybody. Enjoy the rest of your WonderCon.